Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Lady Hubbard, whose new novel is The Rip King. We'll also hear from Arthur Hardy, publisher of The Mardi Gras Guide. Lady Hubbard burst onto the scene with The Talented Ripkins, which received the 2018 Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence, as well as the Hurst and Wright Legacy Award for Debut Fiction. Today, we're talking about her second novel, just out, called The Rib King, about the patriarch of that family. Lady Hubbard, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you. It's wonderful to be talking with you.
Now, one of the things that awed me as I read The Rib King was realizing just how long you've been thinking about this book, because the figure of the Rib King was always there, hovering in the background of The Talented Ripkins.
Yes. The book itself is a extension of that. My original thought was of him as a character in The Talented Ripkins, and I just expanded it into a novel. But that's the origins of it. He is the family patriarch in that first book, and they all... he's like a touchstone for each of them. So they all have, the only image they have of him actually is the label on a can of meat sauce. And what I said in the book, because that was part of, I sort of expanded on the theme when I wrote the novel as well, was all they have is this very distorted image of the man. And they have to learn to see through that. So what they see when they look at it is not him, but what he endured. And mm-hmm. So the memory of what he endured is what they are holding on to, and they're all doing it in different ways. So in that book, he was really about the idea of tradition as sort of a willful act. And then I just expanded it. So I started writing the book in around 2014. So before The Talented Ripkins came out, I was already working on thinking about this man's life.
Well, you're a student of mythology and folklore, and you're just building your world.
Yeah. Yes. I felt like by the time I wrote The Talented Ripkins, the first book, that I knew absolutely everything about all of these characters. There's so much that didn't make it into the book. For me, it was necessary to sort of overwrite a lot. I know all kinds of things about where they come from and their relationships to each other that are not in the book. They're just notes for the book. And that's, again, how The Rip King began.
Now, this is a world that very much mirrors our own in that it's a world of systemic racism. The title character, the Rip King, is August Sitwell, and he survived a racist massacre in Florida that's haunted him his entire life. So tell us a little bit about him and what he means to you. He's a man of contradictions, but he seems to have many good intentions, and he fulfills a really complex role in the white household to which he's attached, the House of the Barclays.
It's very interesting for me, in terms of the process of writing it, because always, I think, because of the way I came up with the character, I was thinking about an emblem of the past and what it meant in the present. So even though it is a historical novel, the things that were going on in the world today were very much on my mind when I wrote it. I started in 2014, and there was a lot of talk about the vulnerability of African-American children to systemic racial violence. And so I think I was struck probably because I was writing a book that 100 years before, the fact that this anxiety would still be present. It's like a life or death situation in the minds of a lot of parents. As much as things have changed, that had not changed. And so that really became the primary motive of the character of Mr. Sitwell. For all the other things going on around him in the book, he is really trying to preserve the lives of three children that work in the household with him. So part of the reason why he's so concerned with his employers maintaining an illusion of financial stability is because he feels like that house is in some ways a safe place to hide and for the children to hide, and he does not want them to wind up without jobs and out on the street. The inspiration for that really had to do with things that were happening in the present and sort of just placing that in a context that was 100 years ago, really.
And the thing that's so interesting is that I love those three boys. You know, the Barclays take them in because they want to appear, you know, magnanimous and say that they're taking in these African-American orphans.
Right.
But they're just such charming kids when they're reading, when they're being read to, when they're doing their work and goofing off and having adventures. They're such fully realized characters, and you grow to love the kids.
Yeah, well, I did. I certainly did when I was writing them. Those three actually, again, are mentioned in the first book, and only one of them is still alive, and he's very, very elderly. So that was kind of interesting for me as well, to just imagine what their childhoods were like or what. So I had a very strong sense of the people they would become when I wrote it as well.
Right.
So it was very nice to sort of explore what they were probably like as children.
Now, while much of the action in The Talented Ribkins took place in Florida in more contemporary times, in The Rib King, you moved to a city that's farther north, but still very divided, in 1914. And it has its share of dangers with riots and demagogues and racial division and just general precariousness.
Yeah. Part of the reason I put it in, it doesn't say it in the book. I did all the research for place at that time was based on Chicago. And part of the reason I did that was because of my interest in the Chicago World's Fair of 1893, which I actually wrote my dissertation on. But a lot of the context for the action of the book has to do with commodities and the circulation of commodities and sort of the marketing of African-American identity in relation to commodities, right? So a lot of it has to do with their relationship to specific products and also the fight to be acknowledged as the producers of culture, which is a very fraught subject because, of course, we once were commodities ourselves, African Americans. So it's about dealing with the legacy of that through commodities. That was sort of what that was. And the Chicago World's Fair of 1893 was sort of very, it's often considered a very significant moment in terms of introducing a lot of newly available products, things that people never thought they needed before because they just didn't exist or there's no way they could have had access to them. So that is, of course, also where Aunt Jemima was introduced,
right,
with weed and all of these things that are still around and talked about today. So yeah, so Chicago was very important to me. I don't name it in the book because it's not a book about Chicago, and I thought that would be somehow clarifying that it's not a book about Chicago, but the setting was the same. Really important to me in terms of conceptualizing the larger story.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Lady Hubbard, author of The Rib King. The second half of the novel is from the point of view of Jenny Williams. One of the things I loved about Jenny was her determination to tell her own story.
Yeah.
And how she resisted the stories other people told about her, or the way they told her story.
Yeah, the book, because it's divided into sections. I think there's a certain nihilism that's animating the first section, but it's not inevitable, but there's something more logical. There's so many reasons to not maybe be hopeful. And I think that the force that really animates Ginny's being is hopefulness, and that it expresses itself as this will to recreate herself, that she just continually recreates herself and imagines new possibilities for herself, as opposed to seeing her circumstances as ever really defining her. You know what I mean? So I think that that's actually when I think about African-American culture. So it's kind of unrealistic. Her aspirations are not the most realistic. When I think about African-American culture, I do think that it's like just willfulness and the ability to sort of recreate and reimagine that has led to so many contributions that African-Americans have been able to make to this culture and society, despite everything. She kind of represents that for me.
Now, this is a novel with so many ideas, lady. It's just bursting at the seams. I mean, there's the idea of vengeance. You know, what does vengeance really get you? And then the desire to have African Americans conform to certain ideological movements. There's lots of demagoguery in this novel, which we see. And there's plain old garden variety sexism and economic racism. And it's one of those novels that just, I can just see your brain like ticking away a million miles a minute as you did this.
While I was writing it, It's interesting. There are a lot of things that I have questions about that wound up in the novel. And I think they're related, or they have an inherent relationship to each other. And the process of writing it for me was really trying to unpack that, to really think about the relationship to between all these different issues, and to unpack that, which is part of why I think it's sort of soothing to put it all in a narrative and try to make sense of it for yourself.
All your writing has such momentum. Characters are going places. They have things they want to do, or they have deadlines. And this is one of those novels that reads like it was written flat out with great urgency and passion. So did you feel that way as you were writing? Did you have that kind of sense?
I mean, I was writing it for about 4 years. So that means that it did not all the time feel like it was just coming out. There was a lot of editing, a lot of trying to fit all those ideas and things together. I like story, and I think for me there's something soothing about trying to figure out a way that all these different things I'm interested in, it helps me to understand things, the process of writing them, and I do appreciate story. So, yeah, I wanted it to have movement, but I think it was very conscious effort to make it move. So I don't know, I mean, given that it, the amount of time actually took, so it was not always easy.
Well, at the end, tension certainly builds. It's twisty, turny, you know, surprise after surprise. It's just amazing. But I was curious, did you feel like you were writing into the face of current events, especially if you're writing it during the past 4 years?
Yes.
So much happened.
I know. It's true. Yeah. So I was thinking it's very strange that it's being published the same year that they're supposed to finally retire Aunt Jemima. And that was actually in the news because of everything that's been going on, or that went on this summer. But yeah, definitely. Again, writing it really was a reaction to things that were going on in the world and that have been going on since then. So when I started, it was really around the time I first heard Black Lives Matter, right, as a slogan or rallying cry. So yeah, it definitely, I think, affected the writing and my ideas about the writing as I was doing it, all these changes that we have been through.
And so here you are with a pub date between Martin Luther King Jr.'s day and the inauguration of a new president. It's like, there you are.
It's pretty wild right now what's going on in the country.
So are you staying with the Ripkins for your next book? I know you have a book of short stories coming out later this year.
Yes, I have I think it's supposed to come out next year. It's a collection of short stories that are totally unrelated to the Rip King or the talented Ripkins. And yes, I'm also working on another novel set in a completely different universe. And it has, again, a completely different set of concerns.
All right.
Yeah. So, and that's been fun for me.
So tell me about your residency at Studio in the Woods and what it meant to you to write there.
Oh, it was really, really great. It's so peaceful and beautiful out there. And it's really nice to have been able to spend that time. I did a lot of editing while I was there at that residency, and it was really it was a wonderful and very fulfilling experience. It's beautiful out there.
It's just across the river, but it's a world away. I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing, and I'm really appreciate that I had the opportunity to do that. So I'm very grateful to my Studio in the Woods for the fellowship that I received. So that allowed me. I was able to spend a total of 6 weeks there while I was working on the book.
Well, okay. I'm grateful to them for this book then.
So am I.
Oh, man. Okay. We've been talking with Lady Hubbard, whose new book is The Rib King. You can meet her virtually, of course, when she appears in conversation with culinary historian Jessica B. Harris. That's Tuesday, January 26th at 6, presented by A Studio in the Woods and the Tulane Center for the Gulf South. Go to astudiointhewoods.org to register. Lady, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
As the publisher of the Mardi Gras Guide, you can rely on Arthur Hardy for all your carnival answers. And even though we won't be parading in the traditional sense this year, one thing stays the same. The Mardi Gras Guide is out in its 45th edition, and this year you have time to read every word. Arthur Hardy, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Happy to be here.
So tell me what went into the decision to go ahead and publish this year. That had to have been hard.
Temporary insanity, perhaps? I don't know. we looked at the numbers and said, are you kidding? No, I just thought it was important to keep it going. And frankly, I was afraid if we didn't publish 1 year, out of sight, out of mind, it might have been very hard to come back next year. So we made the decision. We lost more than 2/3 of our advertisers because guess what? They're all in the hospitality business and
right.
Ain't there no more. But anyway, we thought it was important to keep it going, and I'm glad we did. The reaction's been tremendous.
Well, it's a beautiful addition, and as the cover says, no parades, no problem. Do it different, do it safe.
But no problem. A few people have called me and said, what do you mean, no problem, Buster? I'm out of business. Yeah.
Right.
I resemble that remark.
So you have some great information about history in this edition. You have the premiere of the 20th Century Fox film, Mardi Gras at the Sanger Theater in 1958.
Yeah, that's kind of a fun thing. It's a terrible movie, but it was a wonderful premiere. The Picayune said it was the biggest crowd on Canal Street other than for a Mardi Gras, for the premiere. Had people from around the country coming in to see it. All the stars were here. Pat Boone was the lead actor in it. And it was just a fun event. And a lot of people don't know about that. So we did a story on that. And I think the story that's got the most traction so far is the story on Margus and his participation in Carnival, which was significant. And Margus has a second life right now. People are really into Margus thing.
Well, you have a salute to two big names that we're missing, and one of them, of course, is Morgus. So
yeah.
Talk a little bit about him. You see a picture of him not in Morgus drag in the Mardi Gras Guide.
He loved Mardi Gras, and he did some really fun things, live shots, I think for Channel 6 at the time from Gallagher Hall. And he had his own little crazy crew that he started when the Dorothy May Taylor incident was so hot about crews discriminating, he had an open door policy for his crazy crew. All you needed was $10 and a recommendation, I think, from somebody from the Ninth Ward or some silly thing like that. But he was such a clever guy, you know, and it wasn't just funny, it was clever.
Mm-hmm.
Really did some cool things.
And how many people do you think know his real name?
Not many. I mean, I knew of Sid Noel, but I learned a couple of years ago his real name. In fact, I met him at Christwood Retirement Home. I was having lunch with Bob and Jan Carr, and he was at the next table.
Ah.
Very unassuming. And Bob Carr said, Sid, come say hello. And hello, how are you? And he said, you're Morgan? Oh, my God, I can't believe it. You know, I was like a kid again.
And then, of course, you have a salute to Blaine Kern.
Dear Blaine, gone but never, ever, ever forgotten. What a force, and just a very significant person in the whole history of the celebration, not just the last couple of decades, but forever.
Now, you have no shortage of great things about women in this edition. And I was fascinated to read about the Italian-American women who make up the Elanians.
I know. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
I'd known of that organization for a long time, and last year they had the 80th anniversary, and they don't do a traditional ball anymore. But this is a very significant group. Someone who was most helpful was Mr. Sal Cirio out at the Italian-American Cultural Center, which is at the main Jefferson Parish Library on Napoleon Avenue, second floor. And he is the expert, the go-to guy on anything to do with Italians in New Orleans. And he had a ton of information about it, about the group. And they still exist. And it's just, it's wonderful to see the various groups and how they fit into this puzzle that we call Carnival. Just a really cool group.
And then you have a retrospective of some of the queens of Carnival with a great story about the Flying Queen. I love that story.
Yeah, Laura Fennell was just a kick-butt young woman who happened to be Queen of Rex, but also was the, I think, second licensed female pilot in Louisiana. And soon we're going to be posting on our website stories of many of the other queens of Carnival. You know, it's queen for a day, and then what happens? And many of them led ordinary lives. Some of them just did things that you can't believe. One donated $23 million to the Democratic Party over years.
Mm-hmm.
She was an activist. And anyway, it's a pretty neat story.
So how are you feeling about this year's Carnival? What are you enjoying so far?
Well, I'm enjoying the fact that we'll go on and looking forward to 2022 most of all.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing like the houses, float houses, that what an innovative idea there is. There's a chance that City Park may have, instead of Celebration in the Oaks, floats in the Oaks, where various crews will put their signature floats out there. Bacchus is doing some neat things with their app, like a virtual parade. So the creativity is exciting. If people are saying, all right, you took away my parades, but let me show you what I got now.
If you can't go through, go around.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're going to see more things like that. But my biggest question is, what's going to happen on Fat Tuesday in the French Quarter? You know,
yeah.
79, the police strike, there were no parades, but it was one of the most mellow carnivals ever. People hung out in the quarter and hugged and kissed and danced. Can't do that, not legally. So will we be smart and balance our need to celebrate with the need to be safe, or will people go nuts? Will they seal off the French Quarter and people will go to the Marinette? You know, how do you stop people from being who they are? And nobody wants to spoil a party, but, you know, we've got to be safe. So I just a big question mark over what happens Fat Tuesday in the French Quarter.
Well, we'll see. So what will you be doing on Mardi Gras Day?
You know, I haven't sketched that out yet. I don't know. I might have some media commitments. I have an idea some of the TV crews are going to be scouting around town, seeing what's happening or looking back at what might have happened last year. WYS Channel 12 has a lot of new programming this year, looking back at old parades and old things that happened. So I think we're going to be looking internally and into the past to get us through the present and get us to the future.
So next year will be really exciting.
Oh, it better be. I've already started making my plan.
All right, we're back.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, we've been talking with Arthur Hardy, who's the publisher of the Mardi Gras Guide, now out in its 45th edition. Congratulations and happy Mardi Gras, Arthur.
Happy Mardi Gras, Susan.
Mr. Mardi Gras,
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Garden District Bookshop hosts a virtual happy hour with children's book author Madison Webb, whose new book is Mardi Gras New Orleans, Friday, January 22nd at 5. On Friday, January 29th at 5, Elise Arden appears to discuss her most recent book in the Casket Girls series, The Gates of Guinea. Both events stream live on Facebook and on the Garden District Bookshop YouTube channel. Lady Hubbard discusses her new novel, The Rib King, with Jessica Harris, Tuesday, January 26th at 6, presented by A Studio in the Woods and Tulane Center for the Gulf South. Go to astudiointhewoods.org to register. The 14th Annual Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence will be presented in a virtual ceremony, sponsored by the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, Thursday, January 28th at 6:30. Chicago-born writer Gabriel Bump will accept the honor for his debut novel, Everywhere You Don't Belong. The event is free, and a link to the virtual program is available at the time of the event at ErnestJGainesAward.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.